Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. And as I promised last week, we're going to talk about China this week as part of our round-robin review here at year-end of the global economy. We've been talking about Russia, Ukraine, and Japan, and emerging markets. And today we're going to talk about China. And following weeks here, next week, I will present a review of the global trends, the important global trends that have been occurring and will occur and continue into 2015 to watch for. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about those trends, just an old brief overview here today at the second half of the show if we have time. And then we will go on and look at, in subsequent shows in January here, look at what's happening in the Eurozone, particularly with the new upsurge of financial instability, possibly in Greece and its impact there. And also then, once we get the U.S. GDP figures in January for 2014 here, we'll talk about the U.S. economy. That will conclude our round-robin review of the global economy. In particular with the U.S., we want to try to explain why is it that the U.S. appears to be growing so robustly while the rest of the world is slowing so dramatically. Well, that's an important question that has to be addressed. And as we'll see, the growth is not all that great in the U.S., notwithstanding the second quarter is 5%. We'll dissect that, pick that apart, and explain what's behind that and why it's still a stop-go economy and why in the fourth quarter we will undoubtedly see GDP slow. Of course, earlier in the year we had a major contraction of almost 3% in U.S. GDP. In other words, we have this stop-go still going on in the U.S., and it's becoming more volatile. The swings are becoming larger on the upside and larger on the downside. But if we dissect U.S. GDP, we can take a look at that and see what's really behind this. Is it a sustained trend here with sustained growth factors driving it? Or is it more of this one-off stuff, special stuff, that comes and goes, and they just happen to converge here in the third quarter of this year to give us that 5%. Of course, the 5% isn't really the 5% if you back out the necessary adjustments here for the redefinitions of GDP that occurred and give it a proper inflation adjustment. We could say it's not really all that 5%. And also we can see that the forces that were driving this tend to drive the U.S. GDP always in the third quarter. Why is this? It looks like, you know, for the last three, 4 years, it's always the third quarter that we get the boost. And then we get a real correction, much lower to the downside, at the beginning of the year. Well, is that going to happen again? Well, we'll see. But anyway, enough of U.S. Economy. We'll talk more about that about the middle of January. And we'll talk about Europe, what's happening there after next week, where we'll do this characteristics of the trends of the global economy. But today we want to talk about China some more. Okay, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, recently declared that China's economy is larger than the U.S. In U.S. dollars, more than $17 trillion for the China GDP. Well, you know, you got to take with a grain of salt the GDP numbers, especially when you're doing global comparisons here. Yes, the Chinese economy is very large, second largest, no doubt. indisputable, but it's not really $17 trillion. How do we get $17 trillion? Well, you do what's called a price adjustment, a global price adjustment. You know, we have things that are rising in price here in the U.S., and in China, they have a different basket of goods that are rising. You can't compare apples to apples when you compare the basket of goods, you might say, that they use to estimate inflation indexes. They're quite different. So there's this thing called the purchasing power parity adjustment that economists like to play around with to kind of see if we can get to oranges and tangerines comparisons instead of apples and kiwi fruit or something, right? Okay. So you got to take that with a grain of salt. There's a lot of assumptions in that adjustment, that PPP adjustment. And it just shows that comparing GDPs is, a tenuous task here. And it has a lot to do with your price index. You know, you get your monetary GDP number. That's all the goods and services that are bought and sold times the price. And that gives you your what's called nominal GDP number, not adjusted yet for inflation. And then you got to adjust it for inflation. So what kind of measure do you use to adjust for inflation? Well, in the U.S., they use an index called the GDP deflator, which is very conservative. In other words, it underestimates inflation. It's much less than, for example, consumer price index, which also underestimates, but not as badly as GDP deflator. So you get a low inflation adjustment, results in a very high real GDP number. The lower the inflation adjustment, the higher the GDP appears. And of course, the U.S. Really lowballs its inflation. That way, the government doesn't have to pay as much for Social Security and for unemployment insurance, and business contracts don't have to adjust to the top side and so forth. And they don't have to pay as much to the unions when they demand wage increases, because inflation really isn't that bad, apparently, they say. So we keep the number low, underestimate, lowball it, which means the GDP is high. Well, different countries do that game differently, so that makes it even harder to compare cross-country GDPs. But even within the U.S. GDP, the GDP numbers based on the inflation index estimations are excessively high relative to inflation. Lots of other problems with U.S. GDP. We'll talk about that more when we talk about U.S. numbers here in a couple of weeks. Okay, but let's get back to China. All right, so China, thing to remember is that China, since the crash of 2008-09 and until recently, has been propping up the global economy. How has it done this? Well, when everything crashed, 2008-09, the whole world went down. But China snapped back very quickly with very high growth rates. By 2010-11, they were growing double-digit. In other words, between 10 and 13, 14%. Huge increase. So China blew right through the collapse, whereas the United States has had these relapses. Maybe not full-blown recessions, but on three different occasions, a significant quarterly contraction of GDP, if you want to use GDP as your estimation of a recession, which the general public thinks is done, but of course that's not really how we define a recession, but we'll put that off for now, and we'll just say GDP two consecutive quarters indicates a recession. Well, U.S. has had three different events, quarterly events, where we've relapsed. In other words, we've actually gone negative, but then not two consecutive quarters in a row. Whereas Europe, of course, has gone negative three times, and Japan has gone negative four times. I mean, true bona fide recessions, two plus consecutive quarters of contraction, GDP. And they've had short, shallow recoveries in Europe and Japan. And we've had short, shallow recoveries, not quite as shallow as Europe and Japan. And all that's due to certain specific advantages the U.S. has in its currency, its global position, its defense spending that it can always boost up and down, its ability of its central bank, the Fed, to kind of drive global interest rates and lots of other things. So the U.S., because of its economic empire, is able to mitigate, to dampen the volatility and the contractions, and that's why we call them relapses. Whereas bona fide recessions are two consecutive quarters, Japan, Europe. Okay. Well, unlike this picture for Japan, Europe, and the United States, where we've had this bouncing along the bottom, either relapses or recessions, and stop-go kind of a picture for all of them, way below historic growth rates and normal recoveries, China blew right through it. And, well, why did China blow through it? Well, the reason China blew through it was very aggressive fiscal, i.e. government spending, and monetary stimulus in 2009-10, whereas the United States just did primarily a monetary stimulus through the Federal Reserve, $14 trillion thereabouts of QE and zero interest rates for 5 years. And Europe and Japan also have done QEs and zero rates, which, as I've talked to previous shows, bails out the banks and investors first, and then big businesses, and the rest of us are hopefully somewhere along the line, eventually recover 5 to 10 years later. That's the strategy of the capitalist and the global advanced economies, and they're all following it more or less. Well, in the U.S., we had some token fiscal stimulus being tax cuts and or government spending. Government spending having a bigger impact than the tax cuts, particularly if they're tax cuts for businesses. But Europe, of course, had no such fiscal stimulus, nor did Japan. So it was all monetary, and even not as much monetary as the U.S., ditto Japan, and very little fiscal stimulus because they're not in a position to really be as aggressive fiscally and or even monetarily in terms of stimulus. Okay, so Japan and Europe, virtually no fiscal stimulus. The U.S., token fiscal stimulus in 2009-10, that was the Obama's $787 billion plan, half of which was business tax cuts, roughly, which was then quickly by 2011 retracted again in the U.S. With the deficit deals and fiscal cliff and all that nonsense. Okay, so U.S., a little bit of a fiscal stimulus, which was quickly withdrawn. Europe and Japan, no stimulus at all, just austerity in the starkest forms. But China, big stimulus, 15% of its GDP at the time. 15. Obama's token stimulus, mostly tax cuts, was barely 4% of U.S. GDP. So almost four times as large a fiscal stimulus, which was heavily government spending and government investment, not business tax cuts, in China in 2009-10. Okay, so big fiscal stimulus, snapback recovery for China in 2010. Also, renewed emphasis on its exports. You know, China is a manufacturing a global center and export-driven economy. So to get the economy going again, Chinese government not only increased significant spending, government investment spending, but it took actions to increase exports, Chinese exports. Okay. 15% GDP. Fiscal government spending. By the way, government spending in China is 45% of GDP. 45. How much is government spending in the U.S. as a percent of GDP? Well, government investment. I mean, direct investment in plant and equipment and structures, 15% in GDP. How much of that of the U.S. is government spending? Well, in the U.S. it's a little over 20%, but in terms of real government investment, as part of that 20%, we're looking maybe 5%. You know, real government investment. Most of that's done by state and local government anyway. And, you know, most of the U.S. spending is on defense or on transfer payments. So it doesn't really stimulate the economy. You know, war spending, defense spending generates relatively few jobs. And a lot of that flows overseas, a lot of that spending to U.S. Imperial partners who share in the defense spending. And in the U.S., we don't have this tradition of direct government investment. Well, China, most of that 15% of GDP was direct government investment. 45% is government spending of the economy in China. A lot of that goes into housing and infrastructure. And that's where a lot of that 15% went. It went to housing and local infrastructure, you know, roads and buildings and bridges and so forth, that kind of stuff, railroads, et cetera. So it had an immediate, significant impact on the Chinese recovery at the time. That was contrasted, that China policy, that fiscal government spending, government investment-intensive government spending, had a significant impact, and it really contrasted sharply with what the rest of the advanced economies did not do, right? U.S. and so forth. We've been talking about infrastructure spending, trying to get it going, but gets very little traction in the corporate-dominated Congress that we've had here in the U.S. for some time. Can't get the infrastructure spending going in the U.S., as a result, we don't get as much of an economic recovery going, and haven't. It's been stop-go at a very low rate, as we've said. Okay. Now, in addition to that 15% fiscal stimulus, government investment-focused fiscal stimulus, China also engaged in a big monetary stimulus. That took two forms. One form was its own central bank, the People's Bank of China, pumped a lot of money into the economy in 2009-10. Just as the U.S. did, the Federal Reserve pumped a lot of money into the economy. But there's a big difference between their monetary central bank stimulus and the U.S. Fed's. The U.S. Fed stimulus largely went to finance bank bailouts, and also to bail out big investors who had invested, you know, in subprime mortgage bonds and so forth. So a lot of the U.S. $14 trillion minimum went directly to those folks. And what did the banks do? The banks sat on it. They filled up their losses on their balance sheets. Hoarded it, or they lent it to shadow banks. And I'll explain what we mean by shadow banks as opposed to commercial banks. They lent it to shadow banks that then lent it abroad. Or the U.S. banks, you know, J.P. Morgan, so forth, loaned it to large multinational corporations who mostly were expanding abroad as well. Or they lent it to non-bank companies that used it to buy back their stock and to pay out dividends and so forth, because rates were so low, it was cheaper for these companies just to borrow the money and pay their stockholders and so forth, and then sit on their otherwise cash hoards. You know, U.S. companies, both bank and non-bank, are sitting on huge cash hoards, huge, trillions of dollars, multi-trillions of dollars we're talking about here. And you know, it's all been because of a lot of this free money that's been pumped into it from the central bank, the Fed. So a lot of the Fed stimulus did not go into really stimulating the U.S. economy. It flowed offshore, or it went into financial securities onshore or offshore. That's why the stock and bond markets boomed, derivative markets, you know, foreign currency markets, and so forth from 2010 to today, you know, record gains. A lot of stimulus went there, financial assets, or they went offshore to emerging markets, which then were booming and aren't anymore, for reasons we discussed last time. They just sat on it, or large multinational companies, pharmaceuticals, techs, they just sent it abroad, stuffed it into foreign subsidiaries so they wouldn't have to pay taxes here. And that's where the U.S. stimulus went. But unlike that in China, their central bank stimulus went to finance infrastructure and local housing and other industrial projects related to their exports. Okay, so quite a different effect here from monetary stimulus. And, of course, the fiscal stimulus, 15% government investment, is different than the fiscal stimulus here. So fiscal monetary policy over in China was quite different, focused on really stimulating its real economy. And the real economy took off. Snap back growth 10 to 14% for several years. Now, a problem with this, though, was part of the monetary stimulus by China at the time was to encourage Western capital to flow into China. In other words, not just monetary supply generated by its own central bank, the PBOC, People's Bank of China, but also policies, measures to encourage Western investment, Western banks. And you know, the U.S. Beats every year with its Chinese counterparts at a senior economic level over in Beijing. And for years they had been demanding Beijing to open up its own economy and banking system to Western bankers. So this crisis was a good excuse, and China opened up to Western bankers. Now, that include not just regular commercial banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and those guys, but it included shadow banks. Well, what are shadow banks? What are we talking about when we say shadow banks? Well, a few defining characteristics of shadow banks as follows, right? Shadow banks are unregulated banks, unregulated, unlike your commercial banks that hold depositors, retail depositors, people like us, where there are some regulations, not so much anymore, but still some. Shadow banks are the banks for the rich folks, for the investors, and their whole purpose is to make big returns for investors, double digit, 10, 20, 30%. But to do that, you got to take big risks. But that's what rich folks would like to do. They got a lot of extra money, so they're willing to take risks to make even more extra money. And that's what shadow banks do. You know, investment banks, insurance companies, even pension funds. They're not so risk-oriented, although they become increasingly so. But boutique banks, trust companies, asset management companies, hedge funds, private equity firms, et cetera, et cetera. These are shadow banks. And the main characteristic is they're unregulated. Okay. Now, that's not the only characteristic. They are, as I said, they seek high risks, high return profits for very high net worth individuals and institutions. For only the very rich folks, really rich folks, people who generate 5 to 25 million minimum in new income every year from their investments. That's net new income. That's not assets. That's net new income every year. Those are the folks that invest with the shadow banks that I've just mentioned examples. Right, this money is highly mobile. There's a whole network of highly liquid markets. In other words, you can put your money in, take it out real quick around the world now. The shadow banks do this on behalf of their investors. Highly liquid global markets. They create new kinds of financial securities all the time. Credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, derivatives of all kinds, etc. They create these things because there's so much money out there by the rich folks now, so they can speculate. It's their global casino, you know. The shadow banking global structure is the casino for the really very rich capitalist investors. Those folks don't go to Las Vegas. You know, only nutcases go and waste their money in Las Vegas because it's all, the probability, it's all rigged against you. Well, they don't like that. They like something that's predictable or that they can influence, rig it for themselves. New financial securities that are highly leveraged. In other words, the institutions they borrow from, in other words, they get credit, put some of their own money up, put credit, get credit from the shadow banks, and then they invest. So it's debt-intensive, highly leveraged debt-intensive investment in which you're chasing asset price appreciation, and you're even creating it, and very volatile. Okay, so those are the shadow banks. Well, when China attempted to boom past this crisis 2009-10, not only fiscal policy, but monetary policy opened up itself to the shadow banking institutions. The big attraction to the shadow bankers, of course, was shadow bankers, you know, big capitalist investors, same thing, the fact that this booming economy now in China meant that the Chinese currency, the yuan, would continually rise, which it did. You know, the Chinese prior to this had kept their currency sort of pegged to the dollar, so they could stimulate their exports, but now they allowed their currency to rise. Well, that's a perfect speculative play. When a currency is rising and you know it's going to continue to rise, you jump in, you shadow bankers and high net worth investors, and you invest in it, you drive it up by pumping a lot of money into it even further. Well, that was a big play for them, the Chinese currency, the yuan, after 2010. The other big play was the construction, residential and local commercial construction boom that occurred in China. And a lot of the shadow banking money flowed into local housing and local government infrastructure booming. The result was a huge increase, a bubble in housing, residential housing in China and local projects in China, as well as the currency rise. So three really nice plays for speculators, i.e. shadow banks and their investors here. And what we got out of this was a bubble, three bubbles at least, you know, in currencies, commercial construction, residential housing in China. Now you take that bubble and, you add to it real government investment, 45% of the economy, and all this free money flowing in, a lot of liquidity, and you get the double-digit GDP growth for 3 years here in China. But as what historically always happens, when you get a real boom and you get this asset speculation on top of a boom here, the asset speculation assumes a life of its own and a growth of its own. Now, that always happens, you know. Bubbles, asset price bubbles, always begin on a real growth base, but then run away from that growth base and keep running while the real growth begins to slow. And finally, you get this big gap, and something has to break, and the bubbles eventually break. But the bubbles are based on debt and credit and debt, taking on credit and debt to buy more and more of the financial assets based on the real assets. And the purchasing of more and more debt, of course, does not go away when the crash comes. The investors still have to pay that debt at the higher interest rates that they borrowed at some point, even though their income has collapsed and the basis, therefore, for financing, i.e. paying for that previously incurred debt disappears. That's when you get defaults. Can't pay the principal and interest on your previous incurred debt. Defaults. And with defaults come more asset deflation of what you had purchased and maybe your whole company and your whole bank or whatever. So you get into a downward spiral of debt default deflation, and that marks a financial crash. That's the main characteristic of a financial crash, this interdependent spiral effect of previous debt driving deflation in assets and therefore defaults, okay, and higher rates of defaults occurring. Okay, so the bubbles were beginning to get significantly large in China, these three main bubbles. And in early 2013, the Chinese government decided they're going to try to cool off these bubbles, right? Cool off the speculation in currency, their currency in housing and in local government infrastructure building. In other words, somehow they decided to cool off these bubbles. Well, that meant you had to cool off the shadow banks and all this money they're pumping into China. A lot of it, again, coming from the central banks in the U.S. and elsewhere, who were getting all the free money from the Fed bailout, Federal Reserve bailout, and then just passing it on to the shadow banks that pumped it into China and into emerging markets as well. Which we've talked about before. All this, a lot of this money, free money, has flowed from the central banks to the advanced economies, flowed right out of their economies and into, quote, the emerging world, emerging markets, and a big part of that, of course, in China. In fact, the lion's share of that in China. Okay, so somehow they had to cool off the shadow banks if they wanted to cool off the bubbles and speculation. And this was in the spring of 2013. And what China decided was the PBOC, People's Bank of China, that, we've got to somehow retract some of this money supply. And how do you do that? Well, you raise interest rates, right? So the PBOC raised interest rates and started to look at other measures to stop the flow of that they had originally invited of all this foreign capital, including speculative capital, flowing into China. All right. China faced a dilemma. In other words, by 2013, how do they check the excess inflation going on in housing and in their currency? Right? How do they reduce the financial impact of the shadow banking system that had their claws deep into China by this time? And China also, at the same time, was trying to figure out a way to transition from this massive dependence on government investment, 45%, to more consumption-based growth. You know, longer-term, less government debt-oriented consumption. Base growth. At the same time, how do they keep the economy growing in high single digits? You know, maybe not 10-14%, but 8-10% is what they wanted. Not an easy task to do, but that's what that was the dilemma they faced. Okay, so in the spring of 2013. In order to cool off the shadow bankers and the speculative bubbles, China raised interest rates. The PBOC, central bank, raised interest rates. Interest rates would make it less desirable to borrow debt to finance all the speculation. Okay. Well, what happened, though, was the higher interest rates cooled off the rest of the economy more than it slowed down the bubbles in housing and construction. Yes, it had more of a negative effect on the real economy than the rest of it. It also caused the currency to continue to rise. Higher interest rates makes the currency more attractive. So it stimulated the bubble in further in the currency side while it was trying somewhat unsuccessfully to prick the bubble in on the construction side and the local government side. It also meant higher interest rates by the Chinese government and central bank kind of pushed the local governments into doing even more deals on local infrastructure with the shadow banks. So it had the opposite effect there, too. It pushed the shadow banks deeper into relationships with local government. At the same time, it made the currency play, speculative play, even more attractive. And it slowed down the real economy and didn't have that much of an effect on the bubbles. So it kind of didn't work, right? So what did the government do as part of this policy shift here? Well, the GDP began to slow. And that meant that the government would have to shift somehow to more export growth as it continued with this monetary retraction here and slower fiscal spending. You see, the government didn't want to keep spending 45% GDP on these projects. It made the company country too dependent on direct government investment. They want to move to more consumption. But yet they want to keep their export manufacturing sector growing while they tame the shadow banks. See, it's a real dilemma for them. Interest rates rose, but it slowed the real economy more than it tamed the shadow banks and slowed the bubbles. Again, in some ways it even stimulated more speculative shadow banking by driving local government into the arms of the shadow bankers even more, where they could get cheaper money than borrowing at the higher rates from the China government and central bank. Okay. About the same time, too, what was happening was shifts began occurring almost simultaneously in the rest of the world economy. The U.S. Announced that it was going to the Federal Reserve Central Bank was going to retreat from its policy of money injection also in the form of QE. And that caused a lot of consternation and hiccuping in emerging market economies because that signaled that the U.S. would probably at a subsequent date raise interest rates as well. Okay, less QE flowing out into emerging markets and higher interest rates both meant, time to pull your money out of emerging markets, Mr. Shadow Investor, and bring it back to the U.S. for the higher rates of return that were now occurring or would soon occur. So a big negative impact on emerging markets. The money started flowing out. Their stock markets began declining and so forth. I'm talking about a lot of Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, to some extent Indonesia and other BRIC countries, all started to feel the pressure. The Fed backed off and continued with QE, and now, of course, it's finished with QE, but now it's talking about moving to the next phase, raising interest rates. So emerging markets started taking a hit. Now, they start taking a hit at the same time that China began slowing its economy. With these policies at the same time in the spring of 2013. Slowing economy means less China demand for resources and semi-finished goods from these emerging markets. So the emerging markets took a double whammy hit here in 2013 and 14, and that's still going on. Okay, so there is a global context for all of this. And, of course, now they're taking a third hit, and that is further collapse of the commodities that they produce, commodities demand globally, including those big collapse in those emerging markets that are involved with oil production, crude oil production, Nigeria, Venezuela, et cetera. They've got a triple whammy hit here, and that's why their economies are contracting sharply. Okay, so the first response by China to its dilemma of how do you tame the shadow banks and speculative booms and bubbles and keep the economy growing, the first package did not work so well in early 2013, and the economy began to slow in the rest of the year of 2013. Well, what happened was China said, okay, slowing too much. In early 2014, China said, we need another mini-stimulus. We need a mini-stimulus package here to get this thing going. First mini-stimulus package was introduced in June 2013 when it became absolutely clear that the policies earlier in that year were slowing the economy and not doing much about the bubbles. So they switched back, and they tried to re-stimulate the economy. Now, it wasn't as big as a stimulus as in 2009-10. I'm not talking about 15% GDP government investment. I'm not talking about massive monetary liquidity injections by the central bank and by foreign capital inflows. No, no. What I'm talking about is something more limited, to call it a mini-stimulus, you might say. So in June 2013, China announced it was going to shift to a mini-stimulus and more infrastructure investment, not on the scale of 2010, 9-10, but still. The PBOC, Central Bank of China, reversed itself and started a big money injection again into the economy to try to get it going. So more fiscal spending by the government, more policies to boost exports by the government, and the Central Bank of China increasing the money supply again. All right, and the result was, well, we had even more bubbles. The bubbles kept going in China. Because we're feeding the bubbles again with all the money supply, right? And it did not have that much effect on boosting real economic growth. What we see here is that policies to withdraw money from the economy have a pretty good, through higher interest rates, have a pretty quick and significant impact on slowing the economy. But conversely, and this is important because this is a trend everywhere, policies to stimulate through monetary expansion do not have that big effect on the real economy, have more of an effect on asset prices and asset bubbles. See, they're quite different. They're not just the inverse of each other. They're more of the reciprocal of each other. Here, interest rates, which is important to keep in mind, because what happened with the mini-stimulus in China, i.e. now they're pumping more money into it, and it's pushing the bubbles, but not really getting that much new growth. Think about that when the U.S. Eventually here next year, it looks like, well, this year, 2015, may raise interest rates. We kept interest rates in the U.S. at 0% for 5 years. Did not do much to stimulate the economy, right? For the reasons I mentioned before. But conversely, if we raise interest rates, it may have an immediate, more significant impact on slowing the economy than people and economists are estimating right now. That's my view, at least. Okay. Yeah, I've been arguing for quite some time that low interest rates have no effect on the real economy, virtually, and they haven't, because the benefits of all that have gone elsewhere, mostly at the financial asset investment. But conversely, when you raise rates, you're going to really impact the real economy, and that will have an immediate real effect. One of the new characteristics of the global capitalist economy, 21st century here. All right, so getting back to China again, the first stimulus in June 13 did not do much for the real economy, kept the bubbles going, and it started creating default pressures. The weakest, most indebted industries and companies in China, the most efficient, that were producing commodities, steel and coal and so on and so forth, began to crack, began to default. And the local trusts and banks holding their debt and so forth were running the risk of being pulled down with them, so that the Chinese government and central bank had to jump in to prevent the defaults, you see. Prevent the defaults. The debt that builds up during the boom, right, does not go away when the boom ends, but the income to finance that debt, make the principal and interest payments, does disappear. And if you can't make your payments in principal and interest on previously incurred debt, well, then you default. And when you default, your assets collapse even further. And that makes it even more impossible to borrow Nobody wants to give money to a losing venture here that looks like its prices and revenue is going to continue to fall, and its balance sheet and its assets are collapsing. Okay, so you are on the way out the door, Mr. Businessman, in that case. So more focus, China, when it was clear at the end of 2013, more focus was needed, and China attempted to do what? How is it going to tame the shadow banks and the bubbles, at the same time keep the economy growing or prevent it from slowing? Because once the economy slows below 7% in China, annual GDP growth rate, China can't handle its employment growth and other necessary projects. So China's terrified about falling below 7%. Now, China says its regular growth rate's 7.5%, something like that, last year. But most independent estimates are that that's probably overestimated by, you know, 0.5% to 1%. So they're really in the mid 6% growth rate. But the point is, it's continued to slow, whether real terms are the official terms. So in the beginning of 2014, there's no impact from the first stimulus, pretty clear. What they had to do was another stimulus. So that came here at the beginning of this year. And what we got was more government investment, this time not as big. Another mini fiscal stimulus and mini monetary stimulus. In other words, a little bit, but not enough to really make that big of an impact on the real economy. Again, just like the first mini stimulus of 2013, which was a response to try to tame the shadow banks, did not have any effect on the real, very little effect on the real economy, and allowed the bubbles to continue. Here we go now, a second stimulus in 2014. And that was financing some rail projects, and this time, instead of government spending, more tax cuts for small businesses, and stimulating monetarily by reducing what's called the reserve requirement. In other words, saying that banks don't have to keep as much on hand, they can lend it out, and that's a way of increasing the money supply as well. So we get a monetary stimulus. And we also get a measure called deposit insurance to protect depositors from probable defaults increasing, and to keep their money in banks. And then we have policies to stimulate exports coming earlier this year. China sending trade delegations to the UK and to Germany, pumping a lot of money into UK, Germany, and the southern making purchases of bonds in the southern Euro periphery to help out the Eurozone. And it's a major reason why, for a while there, southern periphery bonds began to stabilize and were a pretty good investment. And once again, even for speculators, I'm talking about Spain and Italy, Portugal, places like that, even to some extent Greece. And, of course, Russia, trade deals with Russia. The UK's little mini recovery had a lot to do with China coming in and buying up, putting money into the economy for real asset investments, energy and power and commercial real estate there, Canary Wharf and so forth in London. So a lot of money flowing into Europe with the ultimate objective of trying to stimulate Europe in their economies, and so they would buy Chinese exports, right? If Europe is lagging, their export purchase of China, and therefore China's economy, is going to slow down. So a combination of measures here earlier in the year, tax cuts, some government spending on rail, and a reserve requirement, monetary stimulus, trade-focused kind of stuff, and bailouts of these old industries that were on the verge of default. These were all policies earlier this year. Now, what has happened here is that the slowing economy in China and the slowing global economy has resulted in the bubbles in China, the housing, residential housing bubbles, and the falling yuan policy also took away that speculative play for the shadow bankers in China. So the residential housing bubble has been declining, and the currency bubble has been declining. Other measures to punish speculators were also introduced. Shadow bankers, same thing, in China. Foreign speculators, shadow bankers. They got their own internal speculators, of course. A lot of local governments that were getting in bed with the shadow bankers, cutting deals and enriching themselves, has something to do, not the whole picture, but has something to do with this big drive on corruption, checking corruption in China. A lot of that is local party members and so forth that were getting rich on these shadow bank relationships here, and the bubbles that they were all creating in local infrastructure. Some of that is part of this anti-corruption policy shift here in China. Okay, so some effect, finally, on the shadow bankers and their bubbles, but the problem is still there, right? So long as the yuan, the currency, continues to fall, you know, that dampens the bubble there, and so long as residential housing prices continue to fall, that dampens the bubble there, but they still haven't quite got their hand around this local government infrastructure bubble. China's facing a dilemma, you know, how to keep the economy growing at 7% or more, and how to shift away from all this direct government investment that's driven government debt up to, you know, 200% GDP, last I understood, and while the economy continues to slowly slow. You know, it looks like, even though they're saying 7.1% for GDP this year, it's undoubtedly going to be less than 7.1% in 2015, perhaps even less. Okay, and remember, when China slows, so does a lot of the rest of the emerging market world. You know, China buys their currencies, and if China slows, you know, Europe slows. It's an interconnected global world. You cannot just look at one economy and say, oh, you know, this is how things are going to be down the road, including the U.S. You know, a lot of what you read in the papers, looking at the U.S. very internally, domestically, without considering how can the U.S. continue to grow while the rest of the world continues to slow. Okay. How does China keep its GDP growing above 7% without adding more to its government debt, therefore government spending? In other words, how does it continue to attract foreign capital but not having that capital directed to the housing and local infrastructure and foreign exchange bubble markets, right? How does it grow its exports in a slowing global economy? How does it wean old industries like steel and coal, so forth, off government subsidies and support, while ring-fencing it, as they say, from the effects of defaults on other sectors? How does it tame its shadow institutions? Right? Shadow banking, over $70 trillion of assets, investable assets, in the hands of shadow banks, private equity funds, you know, hedge funds, and so on and so forth. These unregulated, high-risk, high-return private investor institutions, where the very, very rich financial capital, global capital elite, high and very high net worth individuals, the finance capitalists of the 21st century, keep their money and move it around, speculate with it for high returns, and in the process build up debt levels, and in the process cause financial instability time and time again. And this is very clear. This has been building since the 80s, 90s, increased, and so forth, 21st century. Financial capital, finance capital elite are very destabilizing and very dangerous to the system itself. And, you know, they try to get some sort of regulation imposed on these shadow banks, but the U.S. bill, Dodd-Frank, is a joke, and now it's being even picked apart even more with the new Republican Congress that we talked about last week. and even in Europe, Financial Stability Board and so forth, same thing going on there. Very negative examples, you know, this finance capital fund shadow bankers are, you know, behind the boom-bust crash, focused on the subprime mortgages in the housing industry in the U.S., but that was only the tip of the iceberg. It really had to do with all kinds of derivatives, MBSs and CMBSs and CDOs and CDs and so forth, you know, and you put some controls on credit default swaps, but they create credit default swap indexes and get around it. The bankers are always a step ahead, especially the shadow bankers of the governments, and always creating new institutions, new instruments, and new markets outside the regulatory umbrella, which is full of holes anyway, to continue their high-risk investments. And more capital flows out of real asset investment. Why real asset investment is declining everywhere slowly, it's going into this financial speculation. Why? Because it's more profitable. Faster, greater rates of returns. That's where the you know, the capitalists want to put their money, where they can get a bigger return quicker and move in and move out fast. They don't want to invest loan their money to mom-and-pop business. They might take 10 years to get their money out of that, and mom-and-pop may disappear by then. So let's, you know, jump into the foreign exchange market, you know, make our 10% appreciation and jump out, and this or that derivative, et cetera. You know, and we've seen this trend going on for some time. The Asian meltdown of 1997-98, what was that? That was speculation in foreign exchanges in Asia, foreign currencies, emerging market crashes, Russia, Argentina, Brazil, and so forth in the 90s and early 20s, 2000, same thing. You can go back earlier, the junk bond, you know, U.S. stock market boom-bust here in the 1980s, Japan's financial crash in early 1990s. And more recently, all the bond speculation in southern European periphery after 2010 that continued to require those governments to engage in cutting its government spending in order to deal with that speculation and the depressions, you know, in southern Europe. What's going on now between Argentina and the hedge funds in the U.S., but the courts on the hedge fund sides are is another example of how the shadow banks can exacerbate, intensify the contraction of the real economy going on in Argentina now by driving its currency down and so forth. Venezuela, currency speculators, vulture funds causing a collapse of currencies in Venezuela. Probably with the help of the CIA and encouragement of the CIA as they go after Venezuela again. I talked about the hedge funds, private equity firms here in the UK, Ukraine, taking over the Ukraine, right? All the same. China shadow banking, right? 75% growth in 2010-11, 33% growth in 2012, 35 and 13. Now it's slowing a little bit to 14, over close to $4 trillion of shadow bank money pumped into China. Okay. Risk of default rising in China. All right. Crackdown on the shadow banks while they're trying to encourage other real asset investment into China. China's manufacturing is flat on its back. It's not growing at all. 50 indicator, as they say. Below 50, it's your manufacturing contracting. Above, it's not. Well, it's been flat. Over 5 years, $5 trillion yuan in 2010, $23 trillion of yuan today. And the Chinese economy continues to slow. The real economy. So some successes, you know, getting these shadow banks under control, but the economy continues to slow in the meantime. And what's happening in China is an indication of many other examples of how the shadow banks destabilize an entire economy. Okay, Jack Rasmus, next week, join us. We're going to talk about 20 dominant characteristics of the global economy in the recent years and going forward.